today.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Hong Kong leader refuses to resign amid protests. Washington protesters express solidarity with those in Hong Kong. The UN reports shocking acts of violence by Islamic State forces in Iraq. And competing goals could frustrate efforts to fight the Islamic State militants.
Mainly Saudi Arabia and the UAE are stepping up their image as being real Middle Eastern military powers.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Hong Kong's chief executive says he is not resigning his position following repeated calls by pro-democracy protesters for him to step down late today. Leung Chong-ying made the announcement just before the deadline, but he said he is sending his chief secretary to meet with student protesters. Reporter Ivan Broadhead spoke with us minutes ago.
I'm on the street currently. There are around 200,000 people, young students predominantly around me. News has just seeped through to us that CY Leung will not be stepping down. The news was received with some shock, but absolute dignity amongst the students here. There was concern amongst student leaders that perhaps the failure of CY Leung to step down would perhaps incite rioting or protests. To the credit of the students and the broader demonstration, the peace has been maintained. One young man just told me that he saw the failure of CY Leung as an important lesson to the community here as they move along the road to political maturity. So generally speaking, there is calm is prevailing. There's some good humor. It's gallows humor in some ways. Another young lady told me that CY Leung couldn't even resign properly. But it's been a privilege to be here in many ways.
What is the reaction to announcement of the meeting? Are people glad about that at least?
Yeah, I think there was some surprise that the meeting was announced at 10:45 p.m. local time here. Only 45 minutes notice of the meeting. I think that there was a sense that since it was so late in the day and since this deadline had been imposed by the protesters for chief executive, the leader of Hong Kong, to step down by midnight, that given the meeting was called for 11:30 p.m., that he was actually going to stand down. The alternative was that he called the meeting at 11:30 p.m. He didn't stand down so close to the deadline. That actually would be quite a reckless gesture. Politically was the sense on the ground here that potentially the leadership, the authorities here were potentially trying to incite some kind of reaction from the youngsters, from the students, from the protesters in order to legitimize the police resorting to violence to put down any protest.
We've talked before about saving face and how important that is in China. Is this seen as a saving face gesture by the Hong Kong chief executive?
Well, we're out on the streets. There are so many people out here. We don't even have a data connection. So the information that we have that has come in from the conference room is very, very patchy. I don't believe there's any way that CY Leung would stand down or continue in office without the absolute say-so of the authorities in Beijing. So whether or not this saves face of CY Leung, I think, is a moot point. I think the broader question is, what does this mean for Beijing? What does this mean going forward? What decision will Beijing make next? And how will that impact the people here?
And what is your guess on what's going to happen next?
Well, we're at a transitional period at the moment. It's the last day of the public holiday here in Hong Kong. Tomorrow, most of the public is expected to be back at work or back in their university lecture rooms and classrooms at school. I think there's a desperate hope that among the authorities that this will perhaps bring a natural end to the protest. But I'm standing here at 12:30 midnight, and I can still see people as far away as the horizon. I think previous experience of demonstrations in Hong Kong would suggest that this isn't just going to stop tomorrow, that this will go on and on. And, you know, even if people do return home, it would just be brushing the problem under the carpet. This has been going on, the quest for democracy has been going on prior to Chinese resumption of sovereignty over Hong Kong. There are people here, parents here, who've struggled for democracy under the British rule. So whatever happens next, that the problem isn't going to go away. The only way I think that the problem will be solved to the satisfaction of the people out here tonight and the, perhaps the broader community in Hong Kong, is for universal suffrage to be offered to the people.
Reporter Ivan Broadhead speaking with us from the demonstrations on the streets of Hong Kong. There have been solidarity protests in places around the world so people can express their support for the demonstrators in Hong Kong. One such rally was held Wednesday night in Washington. The demonstration was under the banner Global Solidarity with Hong Kong. One of the organizers, Vivian Lee, spoke with VOA's Michael Lippin.
What do you hope to achieve from today's protest?
So basically, today's protest is global solidarity, and we're all here to fight back of the recent protests that's been happening in Hong Kong. And it all started because the PRC wouldn't pass a bill that says that grants Hong Kong the right to select their own chief executive. And it first erupted and then in Hong Kong, and a million, like thousands of students were sleeping in the streets and protesting. And then now it's spread, it's become like a whole movement, also called the Umbrella Movement. And then, so we're here today because we want to show that even us here, Hong Kongers or supporters alike in D.C., would also support this cause, which is Hong Kong needs to have democracy.
How does an event like this come together? What role does social media play in mobilizing, you know, the event here and the events that are happening in other parts of the world?
Okay, social media definitely played a big part in this whole movement, because without social media, we wouldn't have seen all the images and all the footage of the things that were happening in Hong Kong. And in regards to this event, it all started because one of our organizers, Derek, which is actually in New York, but he made the event, and then I joined the board because I started commenting and giving feedback, and I stepped up, and then a lot of other people also stepped up to do this, and then we invited our friends from Facebook, we were doing Twitter, and then we sent our link to the official Global Umbrella Movement site, and then they helped us broadcast, which gathered more people, and that's how it is. So it really is amazing to see how quickly we can get this done in just 2 days, and then we have this turnout.
Okay, well, tell me a little bit about the symbolism of the various items that you brought today. What do you have with you, and what does it all mean?
Okay, so basically the biggest one is the whole yellow umbrella, which is hashtag umbrella revolution or umbrella movement. And it bears a significant meaning because during the Hong Kong protests in Hong Kong, we were attacked by the police with the tear gas, and they were holding guns. And since Hong Kong has no right to bear arms, the only weapon that we had were umbrellas. And it became a symbol because everyone had an umbrella, whether it be to block the tear gas or to shield from rain. So then it all became a whole symbol. And then the whole yellow is the color of freedom, and then we have this whole ribbon going on, and that's also a symbol.
And are you from Hong Kong originally?
I'm born in America, but my parents are from Hong Kong. But this cause actually means extra more to me, because for a person who hasn't lived in Hong Kong ever in her life, I still feel strongly about this cause, because I believe that everyone needs to have freedom to vote, and democracy should be given to a country that still isn't completely part of China yet, because the 50 years still isn't up. So, yeah.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Good luck. Okay.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Vivian Lee, who helped organize a Wednesday night rally in Washington in support of the demonstrators in Hong Kong. Ms. Lee just mentioned that the 50 years for Hong Kong are not up. She's referring to Hong Kong's status as a special administrative region in the Sino-British Joint Declaration for the return of Hong Kong to Chinese sovereignty. A new report lists a staggering array of widespread systematic violations by Islamic State militants against civilians in Iraq, many amounting to war crimes. The report, issued by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq, also documents abuses committed by Iraqi security forces between July 6th and September 10th. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
The report describes a litany of horrors in Iraq committed by IS militants, including attacks directly targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure, executions, and other targeted killings of civilians. Among the many gross violations perpetrated by the group are abductions, rape, and other forms of sexual and physical violence against women and children, the forced recruitment of children, destruction or desecration of religious and cultural sites, and looting of property. Rupert Colville is spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. He tells VOA this is one of the most strikingly awful reports he has ever read. He says the brutal acts of violence committed by this militant group are of an increasingly sectarian nature.
Just a nine-week period, the range of the crimes, every way of harming civilians you can think of, and a lot of them, you know, apparently widespread and systematic. And this is the key element when you talk about crimes against humanity, which is basically one of the worst crimes there is. They're targeting groups purely because they're ethnic or religious nature. They're targeting women. They're targeting children. They're targeting people because of their professions, and so on.
So far this year, the report estimates more than 9,300 civilians have been killed and nearly 17,400 wounded, well over half of them since June when IS seized large swathes of territory in northern Iraq. The report notes these figures are greatly underestimated because UN monitors are unable to access many remote areas to carry out their investigation. Colville says the High Commissioner Zayed Raad al-Hussein calls Islamic State takfiri, that is, a Muslim who accuses other Muslims of apostasy, although Colville adds the High Commissioner does not believe the group is really religious.
They are against anyone who does not fully agree with them. So for this reason, you see ISIL killing Sunni Muslims, as well as Shia, as well as Christians, as well as groups like Yazidis and Kurds and Fa'ili Kurds and Shia, etc., all of whom, or many of whom, are Muslims as well. Takfiri means, you know, basically anyone who doesn't believe exactly what you believe is an infidel, and they'll kill them.
The 29-page report also describes violations of international humanitarian and international human rights law allegedly committed by Iraqi security forces and affiliated armed groups. These include airstrikes and shelling and military operations or attacks that use a disproportionate amount of force. The report accuses militia groups allied with the government of killings, abductions, and other human rights violations that might amount to war crimes. The UN Human Rights Chief is calling on the government of Iraq to join the International Criminal Court so it can begin a serious judicial process, which in time will bring perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity to justice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Syrians fleeing their homes have suffered nearly 4 years of devastating civil war, and now a U.S.-led coalition is launching airstrikes on jihadists in their country. But at least 20 non-combatants reportedly have been killed in the early raids, and civilians seeking sanctuary in Turkey are asking why. Jamie Detmer has more from the Turkish-Syrian border.
The jihadists of the Islamic State, formerly known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, have been quick in seizing the opportunity to take advantage of the civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes aimed at them. On social media, the Islamic State accuses the United States of launching a war against Islam, and some of the 7,000 civilians fleeing northern Syria daily through the border gate in the southern Turkish town of Kilis do not know what to think. One such refugee, who identified herself only as Azra, says all they know is they're scared and that warplanes are striking and civilians again are dying. Azra says American warplanes struck two homes near her house in a town northeast of the city of Aleppo. She says seven people were killed. Pentagon officials say they've seen no credible evidence of civilian deaths caused by U.S. airstrikes against Islamic State militants. The jihadists have seized a huge swathe of eastern Syria and western Iraq and imposed a draconian form of Sharia law that they viciously enforce, killing civilians themselves in the process. But U.S. officials acknowledge that stricter standards President Obama imposed last year to prevent civilian deaths from U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan will not apply to U.S. military operations in Syria and Iraq. The Pentagon, though, says it does everything it can to avoid civilian deaths. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a London-based group that relies on information received from a network of activists inside Syria, says 20 civilians have been killed in the US-led air offensive against the Islamic State that started on September 23rd. Some local groups put the death toll higher and claim 20 civilians have been killed by coalition warplanes. Azra says the picture is bewildering. Yesterday, she says it was US warplanes that struck a town. Before, it was Assad jets bombing her and her neighbours. She insists she can tell between the warplanes, with the US jets making a different sound from the Syrian government's Russian-supplied MiG-23 fighters. This seems unlikely, and Syrian rebel commanders acknowledge that there is a risk that the US and its allies will inevitably be blamed for deaths caused by Assad's warplanes. They say the Syrian regime has increased dramatically its own airstrikes in northern Syria since the US coalition began its bombing offensive. Abdul, a rebel fighter, said they would have accepted civilian casualties caused by US-led airstrikes if they had happened years and even months ago and occurred as part of an offensive against Assad intended to punish him for slaughtering those rebelling against him. More than 200,000 Syrians have died in the brutal civil war, with up to 80,000 of them civilians. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kilis.
Islamic State militants are considered so great a threat to so many countries that former enemies are now essentially on the same team. But as alliances shift and countries redefine themselves, analysts say the long-standing goals of some key players in the Middle East may soon compete with Western goals. And as Heather Murdoch reports from Beirut, they say this could ultimately threaten efforts to defeat Islamic State fighters.
In the fight against Islamic State militants, Gulf countries are emerging as military leaders, conducting airstrikes and hosting the bases used for the aerial campaign. Gulf State Analytics founder Giorgio Caffiero says this is one of the many ways the battle to reclaim lands in Iraq and Syria, captured by the Islamic State, is changing the Middle East.
Mainly Saudi Arabia and the UAE are stepping up their image as being real Middle Eastern military powers rather than their traditional roles of playing a more cautious foreign policy.
But shifting roles have not entirely shifted alliances, and this could complicate the battle going forward, he says. Saudi Arabia has long rivaled Iran and its allies, including Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, whose forces have been battling rebel groups. Officially, the U.S. also wants Mr. Assad to step down and has accused him of committing acts of terrorism against his own people. Both the U.S. and Saudi Arabia support rebel groups in Syria they call moderate, which means they are against President Assad and the Islamic State. But Robert Bletcher, the acting program director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group, says the official line is increasingly difficult for these rebels to believe as U.S.-led forces attack Islamic State fighters with tacit approval from the regime.
That's their line, but it's awfully hard to hold up that argument when you have rebels on the ground who are saying, okay, if you want to support us, why aren't you going after the regime?
And these rebel groups are expected to be on the front lines of any ground battle against the Islamic State, he says. U.S. support for President Assad, real or perceived, could push the groups away from the coalition. The conundrum, says Caffiero, is that it may be impossible to end the civil war in Syria without the Assad regime, which, despite all odds, is still standing. And as long as the war in Syria continues, he says, Islamic State fighters will have space to operate, even if they are defeated in Iraq.
It seems as though this is a rather endless conflict in which U.S. and Saudi Arabia are pushing for an outcome that seems rather unlikely. And again, to repeat, that outcome would be the simultaneous defeat of ISIS and Assad.
But at the moment, Saudi Arabia remains steadfast in its opposition to the Assad regime, but also committed to defeating the Islamic State first. There is also a glimmer of hope that the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is thawing, he says, as they quietly work together against the Islamic State. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Beirut.
Iraqi President Fuad Masum says the barbarity of the militants who have taken control of a third of Iraq and part of Syria has served to unite previously divided factions in the region. In a recent interview during his stay in New York, Mr. Masum told VOA that Islamic State is losing the support of Sunni Muslims, which the militants enjoyed at the start of their campaign. He said Iraq's neighbors have pledged their support to Baghdad's effort to defeat the terrorist group. Zlatika Hoke reports.
Islamic State militants have been attacking Kurds, Christians, Yazidis, Shia Muslims, and others who stand in their way. It is generally believed that the group is led and supported by disgruntled Sunni Muslims who once ruled Iraq, but was sidelined by the Shia-dominated government of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Iraq's president says the initial support has diminished.
The political leadership of the Sunnis are all opposed to Islamic State and know that Sunnis are not beholden to them. Now that Sunnis have seen how Islamic State behaves, they are very worried. The group's dictatorial behavior and backward philosophy has scared all.
In his address to the United Nations General Assembly last week, the Iraqi president said Islamic State must be eradicated or it will rise again. The United States has organized a coalition of Western as well as Arab states to help destroy Islamic State's strongholds in Iraq and Syria. But the United States has not invited Iran to join the coalition, despite a recent thawing of relations with Tehran.
Cooperation or non-cooperation between Iran and the U.S. is their concern. But we saw that the Iranian government was the first to provide us with humanitarian assistance and great cooperation. They even provided weapons to all sides that were resisting Islamic State militants.
President Masum says Iraq also has the support of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Bordering both Iraq and Syria, Turkey has been under pressure to play a greater role in fighting the extremists.
We are ready for any kind of cooperation in fighting against terrorism. However, Turkey is not a country in pursuit of temporary solutions, nor will Turkey allow others to take advantage of it.
Iraqi Kurds have been at the forefront of resistance to the extremists and have received international support. There are concerns that this will strengthen their aspirations for an independent state. Mr. Masum expressed confidence that it will not come to that.
Islamic State was instrumental in uniting all Iraqi groups, because all understood the gravity and danger of the situation facing them. Domestic Iraqi differences and disputes must be solved because their continuation will not benefit anyone.
Iraq's president is a Kurd. Earlier this year, he appointed a new prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, who is working to ease religious and ethnic tensions. Mr. Masum says that a separation of Kurds from Iraq would be a start of serious troubles for the region. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Texas health officials are monitoring 80 people for possible exposure to Ebola, including up to 18 who had direct contact with a Liberian man who is the first patient in the U.S. to be diagnosed with the virus. A spokeswoman for the Dallas County Health Department said none of those being monitored are showing symptoms. The department has ordered the quarantine of four close family members of the Ebola patient, who has been identified as Thomas Eric Duncan. Duncan was diagnosed with the Ebola virus on Sunday. He is in isolation at a Dallas hospital, where his condition is listed as serious but stable. Texas Governor Rick Perry spoke with reporters on Wednesday.
Today we learned that some school-aged children have been identified as having had contact with the patient and are now being monitored at home for any signs of the disease. I know that parents are being extremely concerned about that development, but let me assure these children have been identified and they are being monitored, and the disease cannot be transmitted before having any symptoms.
Ebola has killed nearly 3,100 people and infected more than 6,500 in West Africa. Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are the most affected countries. The chief of the International Monetary Fund says the world economy is still dealing with the legacies of the severe downturn several years ago, with a deposing a disappointing global recovery. IMG managing director called today on governments across the world to adopt policies to aim higher. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey, reporting to you from Washington.